All right. Well, so everybody, welcome. This is Dr. Anthony Cerulli. He's the professor of religion at Hobart and William and Smith College. And he was here about a month ago giving his talk on the Four Noble Truths. And this is the follow-up to that. talk. It's called Buddhist Teaching, Buddhist Experience. And then he'll be having one more talk in another month from now. It's on the calendar. And yeah, it's been a real pleasure to have him here. And so here he is.
Thank you. It's nice to be back. Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming out. I'm going to try. I was going to stand back there and hope not to be in anybody's way, but maybe I'll start off here. We'll see.
Are you guys? We like looking at you. It's good.
The talk today is effectively a follow up from the last talk on the Four Noble Truths and Buddhist teaching, Buddhist experience. I'm going to be focusing primarily on these things down here, the sayings or the teachings of the Buddha as they're found in the Pali Canon, which is this collection of texts. If you were here at the last talk, I talked about the Pali Canon. These three baskets, the Tripitaka of the sayings of the Buddha, the code of conduct for the Sangha, and then the Abhidharma, which is this sort of extensive psychological, philosophical elaboration of the sayings or the teachings of the Buddha. I'm primarily going to be interested in talking about what the Buddha had to say about how his teachings set up this idea of experience. Now, a few things dawned on me as I was preparing this talk, which I think is good. This is part of the reason that it's interesting to be able to give talks like this, is that first I realized that I'm really working at this from a scholarly or an academic sort of viewpoint. I think that will become very obvious to all of you as I start going through it. But it really sort of hit home for me when I was writing this. And second, I found it to be very interesting that here I am talking about this relationship, which is really textual based for me, and when I'm speaking to a bunch of practitioners. And so I think when I'm finished, I really hope that the tables turn, and then you offer to me some things that you see about this relationship that I'll be discussing this morning. Okay. So, just by way of introduction, what I'm going to end up talking about is something that the Buddha talked about at length in a lot of his teachings. It's called ditti. And ditti is a Pali word, which simply means view. Now, one thing I'll just highlight right now is that in the past, I've always used the Sanskrit translations, the Sanskrit words. The Sanskrit version of ditti is drishti. But since we were talking about the Pali canon in particular today, and what would be Theravada communities, I'm going to use the Pali terms up here. There aren't a lot. There'll just be a few. But that's why, if you've noticed the change from things I've said in the past, that's what we're talking about. Now, you saw this slide, something like this more or less last time too. And it's just a reminder that when we look at the Dharma, the Buddha's Dharma, it's a lot of information. There are a lot of ideas being shared. There are lots of what we call doctrine, and I will refer to them as doctrine this morning. But it's not just a collection of teachings which the Buddha said, please look at this, hear these things, and just think about them. But rather, this is something you need to think about, and you need to figure out how to implement them in your lives. It's a method for living. It's a way to cultivate oneself in particular. So view, as we'll see in the Pali Canon, it may, and it often does, relate to the realm of ideas, which means that, yes, we do need to think about these things. It's an intellectual endeavor to think about what the Buddha had to say about the doctrine of no self, or the doctrine of codependent arising, and so on and so forth, or the doctrine of the Four Noble Truths. However, view is also a certain way of setting up oneself to have religious experience. This is what I want to try and illustrate today in the course of what I have to say. The way in which the Buddha talked about ditti, or view, was setting up a way for us to be ready to hear what the Buddha said and then implement it within our lives. So at the end of the day, here I'm giving you the sort of conclusion now, but I'll come back to it again, these grand goals of Buddhism, right? The grand goals of awakening, or bodhi, and nibbana. Here again, you get the Pali and the Sanskrit. Nibbana or nirvana, they aren't possible, the Buddha said, without knowing right view, practicing right view, cultivating right view, experiencing right view. Right view enables a person to know things as they truly are. And now you see the adjective added to view here, right. So we're going to be talking about right views and wrong views, and that's basically the way they're set up in most of the Buddha's discourses. Right views, samadhi, are transformative of both body and mind. This is really important for the Buddha. These things, if you can cultivate right view in your life, it can actually change you. The first reason is very obvious. Once you have right views, you eliminate wrong views from your life, and we'll see why that's important. Right? You want to push out the wrong views, bring in the right views, and those views that you have, the ways in which you're seeing the world then, perceiving things, ideally as they really are, as he usually put it, will influence the way in which you act afterwards. So the views, these things that you think about, the things that affect your perception and your cognition, will then play out in the ways in which you act in the world. And so physically it becomes important to have a right view. Otherwise you'll not have right action, which, if you remember the Eightfold Path from the last talk, is one of the components of that. And ultimately, at the end of the day, there's so much emphasis on right view in the Buddhist teachings that it really becomes the means by which you're able to enter the path that leads to Bodhi, or awakening, and ultimately Nibbana. So here's where I pause for a second before we get into the actual teachings. And I want to just highlight a couple things about what in the study of Buddhism, Buddhist studies and the history of religions, has affected a lot of people. And here I'm thinking perhaps in a narrow way, but scholars of Buddhism, folks who have spent time with the text and talk about the text and write books about the text, how they've approached the question of Buddhist teaching and Buddhist experience. And I think it will be illustrative of how you can see my working out of these two areas when I explain to you that since the late 18th century in North America and in Europe, when Buddhism became a central object of study, very important to a lot of scholars in these two locations, really the goal was to unpack the meanings of the concepts in the text, to translate them, to understand them, but to think about how the texts really were composed, compiled, and then transmitted. And the issue, right, over time was we've got Buddhism in text and we've got Buddhism in society, but how do they relate to one another? So for about two centuries in Buddhist studies, a lot of people weren't really concerned with the second half here, Buddhism in society, until around the mid-20th century you start having scholars ask the question of what they refer to as the Buddhism in society problem. For all this time, when Buddhism sort of hit the radar for a lot of scholars, it was just a textual tradition. And it was something that they were interested in understanding how the text came about. But around the mid-20th century, scholars started asking, well, how do these texts actually factor into the lives of people who claim to be Buddhists? Are they using these texts? Are they just thinking about these texts like we're thinking about these texts? Are they, you know, practical in that sense that they're going to have an impact on one's life? And maybe we need to start asking that instead of just looking at the concepts that are in the text. And so this becomes referred to as the Buddhism and society problem. So we've got Buddhism in text, we've got Buddhism in practice. Now, in South Asian literary cultures going back 3,000 years, it would be very nice if we could say, here's a text that says do X and Y and you'll achieve Z, or do, if you want to achieve A, do B and C. It's not always so clear and so neat to see that, to see this really direct sort of correlation like that to doing something and having this goal and understanding how to put that into your life, right? There are things that are highly philosophical or highly complicated in terms of how to imagine the sort of practices that are described. And things are never quite so neat, I just would suggest. But people started asking, we need to find this out. These things, there are plenty of Buddhist practitioners. We want to see how these foundational texts actually are implemented in their lives. And so around 1970, a scholar by the name of Melford Spiro decided that one thing to do would be to make ethnography a primary component of this. Go do field work and actually see if the text, the Pali Canon in this case, of in his area was Myanmar and Sri Lanka, what are they doing? Where are people actually, are they holding these texts? Are they talking about these texts? Where do they factor in their lives? And he came up with this multi-layered use of the text to impact people's experience. And he said that for one group of people, this first part here, Nibbana, the texts function primarily to help one try and achieve this release from the cycle of rebirth and re-death. This was a pretty select group of people. This was the monastic order of monks in Myanmar and Sri Lanka, where Melford Spiro was taking a look at. For most people, Nibbana was not the primary reason for reading these texts and trying to make them somehow relevant to their lives, but rather it was this second one right here, karma, merit, and rebirth. What are the things that I'm doing today, right? You know, what I'm saying, what I'm thinking while I'm walking, how I'm interacting with other people, what kind of an impact or influence is that going to have on my next lifetime? This was of great importance to a lot of people. And so the Buddhist teachings on that, on karma, on acquiring merit, doing good deeds and acquiring merit, which will improve your chances for a positive rebirth, or rebirth as a human being at least, in the next lifetime, were really critical for people to understand. And so the Pali Canon, according to Melford Spiro, was useful in that way. The Buddhist teachings were helpful in that way. Apotropaic concerns, right? It's an, kind of a obscure word. Scholars in the past would have put magical there, I think, and spells or something like this. Really, this is just a concern for how to ward off evil influences in one's life, or how to ensure well-being for oneself, one's family, protection from the evil eye, and these things. They're very common in, concerns in South and Southeast Asia throughout history. So these are the, this is the multi-layered approach. Another scholar came around, a guy named Richard Gombrich, who also said we need to go on the ground. We need to go see where people are and what they're doing with texts, or at least how they're discussing them and talking about them. He said that the Pali Canon, or any canon for that matter, because Pali is just one of the canons. There's the Chinese canon. There's the Tibetan canon as well. The canon is not Buddhism, right? It's not Buddhism. Buddhism is what people are doing. And he said this right here, and I think it's very, very true. People say they believe certain things and do certain things because these texts tell them they should say these things, believe these things, and do these certain things. But at the end of the day, what people actually believe and do is sometimes different than what they say, right? People's lives are complicated, in other words, and the texts are just ideal models. And so you need to be able to understand how people's lives are complicated, and this requires a very close attention to the lived realities of people. And then you need to be able to weigh these two things in tandem and see how they match up. And this requires a kind of micro study. You can't make broad generalizations. It's very helpful for the field of Buddhist studies, I think, which was prone to big generalizations prior to this era. More recently, going back to a text-based sort of approach, but I think in an interesting way, a guy named Stephen Collins came up with the idea that concepts that are critical to Buddhism are actually woven into the fabric of the Pali Canon, and these concepts suggest various things about the social world and human behavior. So there's imagery in the text that actually reflect social experience of practitioners. So you'll read about things like a seed and its fruition illustrating the flowering of consciousness, or a story about a house which is supposed to be an image that reflects the experience of one's body, and so on and so forth. So this approach right here suggests something very different than what these two approaches say right here, which is that the texts themselves were compiled with knowledge that people are going to be reading these and they need to know how they're going to have application in their lives. Okay? So the compilers of the text put them together with an awareness that they were meant to be operative texts or generative in terms of producing action in society. These are the three sort of most recent approaches that changed the field of Buddhist studies, I think, in a lot of ways. So these are the question, Buddhist texts and Buddhist practice, is a perennial question in the history of religions too, not just for Buddhism, but for Christianity, for Zoroastrianism, for you name it, any religion. This is what historians of religion want to know. How are people using texts? Are they having a fundamental impact on their lives, and so on and so forth? And I think, you know, in this country, we see this sort of question come up about a lot, primarily with respect to Christianity, and the question of a kind of fundamentalist reading of the sacred text, the Bible in this case. Reading it to the letter, or reading it rather in the spirit of what you find right there and trying to fit it within the cultural context of the day. Where do you fall on those two areas? That's the kind of questions that are being asked here. So it may be very obvious to us what we mean when we say a sacred text, but I think it's worthwhile to just be specific about what we mean and precise here. So what is a sacred text? Well, in Buddhism, a sacred text generally is considered to be a storehouse of doctrine. This is what the texts are. They contain a lot of doctrine, a lot of teachings in this way. So we're talking about text and practice in this way, and we could just as easily be talking about doctrine and practice. Now, if doctrine and texts pertain primarily to the realm of the mind, of the intellect, and practice pertains to the things that Buddhists do, ritual activity, meditation, dana, giving offerings, and so on and so forth, we could also perhaps parse this a little bit further and say we're talking about thought and action in this way. Now, here's where, as I'm preparing this talk, I start to realize to myself, well, geez, you know, this is a very sort of, in my mind, an interesting way to approach these two things, text or teaching and experience and so on, but it looks so neat and so nice and everything matches up so well. And I think this is where the academic pursuit of things can sometimes give the impression that things are tidier than they actually are. Right? So one thing in particular on here that I would caution against is we mustn't get too carried away with these categories, okay? And forget, for example, that thought itself is itself a human activity, right? And so we don't want to separate these. And if I were to actually, you know, maybe one day write a book about this or something, I would maybe say text in practice or doctrine in practice and use and in instead of and in this case. We just be careful not to separate these things. I think that's very important. Now, the thing about doctrine, right, these storehouses of doctrine, these texts in Buddhism, sacred texts, is they're meant to shape the ways in which we are able to have religious experience. And this is where we start to see a connection between what we read in the text or what we hear in the text and what we practice. Are they setting us up for a certain experience? Are they making us amenable to or open to a certain experience that the Buddha taught or would have wanted us to be open to and to accept? So the Buddha, for him to address and be heard by a practitioner, that practitioner needs to know how to hear and understand the Buddha. Right? The relationships here, and the text establishes that relationship. And the Buddha models this in his life in a lot of ways, and so you see people who are completely transformed in their own view, as we'll be talking about here, simply by hearing the Buddha talk to other people or tell a story. Or demonstrate what a right view is and what a wrong view is. And this, just observing it, hearing it, can be transformative for some people. So now we come back to Ditti after that little excursion through the Buddhist studies. Yeah?
So in the Christian church, there was a period of time where the texts weren't available to people. There was a class that was to interpret, and then did Buddhism ever experience that, or was it always the canon was for everyone and to be read and to be first-hand knowledge?
Well, this is an interesting question in Theravada, because this becomes a point of critique of Theravada by the later Mahayana tradition, is that, and this will become clearer perhaps as I continue on here, is that one of the critiques of Theravada is that it was closed off primarily, especially the high pursuits of what we call the grand goals to a select group of people, meaning the monastic order, primarily monks. And Mahayana sort of explodes that open a little bit and says that everybody ought to have access to this knowledge. But, the field work or the ethnography of folks like Milford Spiro and Gombrich and more recent scholars as well suggests that the information is widely available, right? And one thing that Buddhism reacted to, the Buddha, in fact, reacted to in South Asia when he was around, was the exclusivity of sacred knowledge within Hinduism that ruled out large groups or classes of people, women primarily too, and the Buddha said this is not the best approach. It needs, whatever we want to say our goals are, they need to be readily available for all people, including the methods for attaining them. Question? Yeah?
On a doctrine, I'm a recovering Southern Baptist. I was brought up in a culture in which doctrine meant orthodoxy, the need to have one speech, one right speech, one way to say everything. And so when I hear doctrine in the context of Buddhism,
yeah.
which for me points me back to looking at my own experience with as clear a view as possible, not with an orthodox view, I get kind of antsy about, no, Buddhism doesn't have doctrines.
Sure, and I completely understand where you're coming from. One thing, and again, this would be a critique, I think, of Theravada by other non-Theravada traditions, is that they're conservative in that respect, and that's usually a characteristic that's given to them. And we'll see that the way that in the Pali Canon, which is the canon for the Theravada schools, the way in which you know if you have a right view or not is pretty simple, is did the Buddha expound it? And if it's not something that the Buddha expounded, which is pretty clear and pretty simple in a lot of ways, and you're not expounding it in that same sort of way, then you don't have it. And so it reflects in an interesting way, you know, the way you nicely describe doctrine, I think. And so it is fitting here, and ditti, at least, means view, but it's also the closest word in Pali that we have to what we understand doctrine, I think, to be in the Judeo-Christian traditions, perhaps, too. So, I understand the sort of rigidity that comes with doctrine. I think some of that rigidity is actually embedded here within the canon itself, the Pali canon, the early Theravada literature.
I wonder if that rigidity itself might be a manifestation of writing. It may say the manifestation of writing within the monastic culture. They're using writing to reinforce their prayer practice.
Yep.
And writing inherently is fixed.
It fixed in the sense of...
Well, I mean, that once you put down the words, until somebody, writes a new document, those words, on the page, don't change.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very formulaic in this way, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly. So we'll see quotes from the Buddha that become, it's kind of like a broken record, right? The way in which you cultivate right view is, you can almost imagine what he said about right observation and then just substitute the words view with observation in this way. And it becomes formulaic in a way that is, I think, meant to be intelligible for people who are used to hearing this sort of procedure. The issue of writing in South Asia is an interesting one in terms of the actual putting things down on text. I think historically in a lot of societies, when you put things to writing, there's a sense that it gives it legitimation, right? Lends a sort of authority to it. And also the expectation that it might persist over a long period of time, long after the people who are putting it down will be around. The oral transmission of texts in South Asia actually was quite a precise activity. So you find, because of the language of Sanskrit in particular, but Pali as well, a very fixed sort of oral transmission as well for centuries before even something like the Pali Canon gets put to writing. So that's fixed as well. But it may be the nature in that way of the language, right? Not necessarily the fact that it's written or if it's oral in the South Asian context, though, but certainly the language is very precise and fixed in that way, I think. Any other questions? So ditti, right, we'll come back to ditti now, view. So we have two kinds of view, essentially, in the text. There's right view, samaditti, and wrong view, micchaditti. And here, I think, gets to the question of doctrine right here, at this point here. So the Pali Canon, right views, very simply, are those views that the Buddha expounded. Wrong views are those that he rejected. And these are often referred to as false opinions. And I think in English we use view sometimes in the way that we might also use opinion, right? But this is not how the Buddha used it. He used it in a very sort of base definitional sense, examination, inspection, or survey. That's the view. What's your ability to examine a situation, see a situation, and inspect it or investigate it? Things before you. That's what it is. It's not an opinion in the way that you say, that's your view. This is my view kind of thing. That's opinion, and this is different in terms of what the Pali literature is concerned with. And he also was quite clear in the fact that not everybody's simply going to have a right view just by virtue of, you know, listening to him and hoping for it and wanting it, but it's something you have to cultivate. And cultivation becomes critical throughout all of this, not only just for creating right view in oneself and one's mind, but in leading to the path towards awakening and nibbana. And there are three stages. The first one is what we call pro-attitude. And basically, this is simply just the stage in which you're open to the basic teachings of the Buddha, which at the heart are about karma, and or the veracity of the basic ideas of karma and samsara. Does everybody know what samsara is? This is the cycle of rebirth and re-death. So at this stage, a practitioner might not really have experienced the truth of what the Buddha was saying, but you're simply open to it. This is why when you read the Pali Canon, you see the Buddha's talking about three types of people. The first type of person he's talking about here is somebody who's willing, you know, to be experience the truth of what the Buddha has to say, but may not really quite have a handle on these things yet. The next stage is about becoming familiar with the teachings, in particular becoming familiar with the idea of right view as the initial spot or the initial component of the Eightfold Path. And here the practitioner understands that her views are going to affect various things along that Eightfold Path, like how my views, the way that I investigate a situation, are going to affect the ways that I talk about the situation, perhaps how I interact with the people and the things in the situation in which I'm investigating, and so on down the road, how I concentrate on it, how I'm aware of it, and all of the various parts of the Eightfold Path. Here, mind-body becomes very obvious to the person. There's a connection there. It's not something we want to separate. It's not something you just think about. But what I'm thinking about, what I'm investigating, what I'm probing is, that's the view, is going to affect my ability within whatever context it is that I'm considering. The last part, this is the third sort of person that the Buddha discussed right here, is how, after you're done sorting out all the right from the sea of wrong views that we're inevitably wading through in most of our lives, I think, then that produces in not just our lives either, but the wrong views that others hold as well, because the company we keep impacts our own views, right? And so we need to be able to see the wrong views in ourselves and the wrong views in others and understand that these things are often interrelated and there's a symbiotic relationship in that way. But the mastery of right view at this stage, for this person right here, produces what he called a liberating insight. And this liberating insight leads to the release from rebirth and re-death, leads to the release from samsara in that way, and nibbana. So quickly, just a couple things about wrong view and right view. So, marchaditi. What do you think the Buddha said was at the root of most wrong views? He's pretty consistent that there's one thing, maybe two things, that most people are hanging on to that keep them from eliminating wrong views in their lives and having right views. Does anybody want
to? Ego is self-craving.
Attachment, craving.
The attachment, craving are both important. Those both reflect that somebody has not shed off the fetters that keep us within the cycle of samsara. Even before attachment and craving, he would often highlight one thing, and somebody, I think, already said it.
Self,
ego. Yeah, that's it. This is what is at the base right here. Belief that oneself and the world are eternal and unchanging. This is really what's at the root, right? And this is what leads to attachment, to sensual cravings, and what I think other people were mentioning, similar sorts of things there. So belief in wrong view doesn't lead to release from samsara. In other words, it keeps producing karmic debt, I guess we could say, in this way. If people are bound to the cycle of rebirth and re-death. And if you're bound to the cycle of rebirth and re-death, you're coming back, you have life. And we all know now, if we from the Four Noble Truths, the First Noble Truth, which is requires a very keen view of reality, is that life is suffering. Right? So if you're in that cycle, you're bound to suffer. Wrong views leads to this, in other words. Right view, on the other hand. So what did the Buddha say was at the base of cultivating right views? And the answer was sort of via negativa in the last quote. Is that, except this part wasn't, and this is important, a dispassionate mode of observation, of seeing what's around, right? of the constructed nature of everything that exists from moment to moment. That includes this thing we call the ego or the self, as well as the world around us. It's all, they're all constructions, things coming together, coming apart, coming together again, coming apart. They're constructions that are always in flux and always changing, and we apply names to them in a conventional sense. And often, if we have wrong view about these things, we think that they're unchanging and eternal, when in fact the Buddha said that's not the case. That was his teaching, for example, of no self and codependent arising. Dispassionate observation is really important to the cultivation of right view. It enables one to recognize and ultimately reject what are wrong views in one's own thinking as well as the thinking of others. Now, I think most of us, maybe, I know I was, when I started thinking about view and right view in particular, I'm most familiar with it here in this list of the Eightfold Path. And this again comes from, the slide comes from the last talk I gave. And I also told you, I think for each one of these things, the Buddha had a little, there's quotes in the Pali Canon, said the Buddha said this about right view, this about right aspiration, speech, and so on and so forth. About right view, he said that right view leads to clear vision, leads to calmness, higher knowledge, awakening, and ultimately it leads to Nibbana. This is very important. This is very big. And it will set up, as we'll see in just a few moments, a relationship with the other components in the Noble Eightfold Path as well. And here it is. These are the Buddha's words here. I'm going to get a sip of water before I read this to you. And how, O monks, does a monk, the word bhikkhu is the Pali term, bhikshu in Sanskrit, who is a friend of that which is beautiful, develop the Noble Eightfold Path and devote himself to the Eightfold Path? Here, O monks, a monk cultivates right view, which produces reliance on detachment, reliance on dispassion, reliance on ending suffering, resulting in relinquishing, and so on. This is it. You start here, right? If you want to cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path in your life, which is the fourth noble truth, right? This is the method for overcoming or producing the cessation of suffering. Then you begin here. This is a very critical point, in other words, to making, to manifesting the noble, four noble truths in your life, making them real. Cultivation's key. And the word in English, cultivation, I think is an apt one, and it fits well with what the Buddha often taught. Right? You're cultivating something like a farmer would cultivate a field. You're cultivating your body and your mind in that same sort of way. You're toiling. You have to put in a lot of effort. And you have to plant the right sorts of methods within your life that can have yield a harvest, can produce something in the end, right? And that's right view in this case. Just like the other aspects or components of the path, one mustn't simply regard these things positively, and this is where that slide earlier on with all the exclamation points is there, is that it's a method. Right? It's something that needs to become real in your life rather than simply something you bat around in your head. And I will admit, I think for a lot of Buddhist scholars, and not all, of course, but I think it stays in the realm of batting around in the head and doesn't go into the realm of practice, which is where I started this talk, saying I look forward to hearing, you know, some of your thoughts on these, since I know you're all here today because you're practicing. So there are two types of right view, interestingly enough. And the first type one, I'll call it, is some right views actually lead to a range of activities that, like donations, charitable things, religious offerings, religious rituals, and sacrifice. Although these acts, the Buddha said, actually are socially beneficial and they help people, they're often good in that sense because they're doing good things for other people, the Buddha recognized that these acts typically reflect in a person an attachment still to the fetters that bind you to samsara. Probably at the heart of that, of course, would be this notion that you're still connected to the idea that the self is an unchanging, eternal thing, right? Which may lead people to do things that are good, in fact, right? But at the end of the day, these acts, right views type one, still keep you within the cycle of rebirth. They'll keep you bound within the karmic world. Yes?
How does that observation fit with the deep need to nurture?
Nurture like children or something?
Children, the earth, society, social comity, governance, without a strong sense of nurturance, one doesn't develop a devotion to making sure that, that nutrition is proper for any of these, you know, children or community, or, and it does bind one, one might suggest, to the reality, the ongoing. It binds one to the ongoing nature of these things. Mm-hmm. That ongoingness is vital.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. And as I hear you speaking, I think you also maybe answered, or at least how I would start to approach to answer that observation, is that these things, right, nurturance in that way, if it's going to produce attachments and connections, binds and so on, are going to be potential impediments to the grand goals as they're discussed. Now, again, I'll just also reiterate that this becomes a problem for later Buddhist schools of the way in which the reliance on the Pali Canon seems to be individualistic in a sort of way and very narrow in, you know, this is where you get the notion of a smaller vehicle. It's a smaller vehicle. It's a, it's a compact car. It doesn't fit as many people in it as the greater vehicle, which is looking for, the Bodhisattva is the paradigmatic figure, which won't take release from the cycle of rebirth until all people can take the cycle of rebirth. And so there's a radical, I think, difference in the foundational ideas as Buddhism develops over time, if I understand you correctly.
Yes, just one matter. You mentioned attachment and connection as if they were synonyms.
Well, no, not necessarily, right? Attachment and being emotionally attached, right? Connection, I guess, would be more the physical relationship that produces that kind, in the nurturance example. Yes?
Seems to me, and I haven't seen your type 2 yet, but my guess is type 1 is maybe what we could refer to as relative bodhicitta, and type 2, absolute bodhicitta?
Yep, our conventional, in the first sense, in the way that most of us live our lives, living in this sort of phase right here. And type 2, which is going to be a bit more extreme, right, is the one that's going to lead you to those liberating insights, right? This is the ones that produce the profound wisdom and insight, right, that lead to investigation and right views, that lead one to master the Eightfold Path. And this is not for everybody. Your ideas become corrupt, or there are no more corruptions in your thinking, and so on and so forth. This is something maybe everybody aspires to attain, to get to this level, but not everybody experiences that, at least in the grand sort of scheme. I think most folks are living here in that way. So that's a nice way to put it. So come back to the idea of cultivation, right? There were those three sort of phases, and this is where the Buddha and the Pali Canon matches up three different types of people. You've got the favorable attitude, the person who's pro-attitude here, open to the Buddha's teachings, open to the things that the Buddha has to say about karma and samsara, perhaps doesn't quite really understand them yet, but is willing, right? The next one is more familiarity and knowledge with the Dharma. And then this last one here, which is the perfected type 2. So this is probably, if we want to think about it in terms of where most people live, probably around in here, maybe definitely these two here. These three aspects of cultivating right view in one's life match up with three different person typologies that the Buddha talks about in the Pali Canon. The first one's called an ordinary person, just a person. This person's said to be living outside of the Dharma at this point. The next person is called a learner. This is somebody who belongs now. This person who has a familiarity, who belongs to the Dharma. Yeah.
This is Shravaka.
Shravaka?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you might be thinking of the next typology that I'm coming up to. Let's just hold on for a second. And then the third one, an adept. Right. This is a person who also, the Buddha says, belongs to the Dharma. These two right here. They are exemplified in this way. Okay. The ordinary person living outside the Dharma and the learner right here are this worldly. They're still within this world, but the thoughts and the views of the adept, the Buddha said, are transcendent. They have no corruptions whatsoever, and this person, the adept, is going to be open to, or yes, is going to be allowed to, according to the various sorts of things that are available to Buddhist practitioners, enter onto the path that leads to awakening and ultimately nibbana in a way that these two will not right here. So cultivating right views is really entails a movement, moving from being outside of the Dharma to becoming part of it or belonging to it. And here, if you're an adept, if you've got that perfected type 2 right view, you see the Buddha says you can become one of these noble people as they're described right here. Stream enter, a once returner, a non-returner, and a worthy one. These differ insofar as basically usually how many rebirths you're about to have left in your life. Stream enter, you're entering the stream. You're entering the stream that leads towards awakening and nirvana. This person has a handful of rebirths left before they take nibbana. Once returner, one more rebirth. The non-returner is not born into the lives in which we know now, but takes a rebirth in a more subtle, pleasurably, heavenly environment before taking nibbana. And the worthy one, which is an arhat, is somebody who, right now, one of us, has already attained nirvana, living in the world of nirvana. When this body stops of the worthy one, of the arhat, will take pari nirvana, and there will be no more rebirths anywhere at that point. But this is only available to this adept in this way. Yeah.
Is the non-returner a deva?
The non-returner, no, it's a sort of subtle existence in this way. So it's not a god, if that's what you mean by deva.
And deva realm being the realm of beauty and pleasure.
This is where the rebirth would take place, in those subtle realms in which, yes, like paradise, those heavenly paradises. Yeah. Good. So how did the Buddha describe right view of an adept? This is the one leading to those four possibilities that we just saw right here. Really, it's about right seeing things as they really are. And it sounds very simple, I think. In many ways, it's easy to hear that and say, yeah, that sounds right. But really, what does it mean? And here he said, what, O monks, is right view? Right view, O monks, is explained as knowledge of pain, knowledge of the arising of pain, knowledge of the ending of pain, knowledge of the way that leads to the ending of pain. So what does that look like? Anybody have it? Yeah, it is. In this way, right view really embodies the Four Noble Truths. And he said it in exactly the same way we see other discourses on the Four Noble Truths set up. Right view is the exact same sort of thing. You're investigating a situation that is your life and the lives of other people, and that's it. It's the truth of pain that is life, and it's these truths are here. John.
Are you just translating dukkha as pain here rather than suffering?
You could do suffering or dissatisfactoriness or unsatisfactoriness, and then you gave a different...
Vexation,
right? I need to remember that for the next time. Yeah, that's the dukkha in this case. Yeah. Why is it important at the end of the day? Well, it might seem... obvious that now, I've been talking about it for a little bit, right? Views help us with all sorts of things that we do. But there's, in terms of the sort of philosophy of Buddhism and the way in which the cosmology, the way you understand your place within society, the Buddha said this is important because right and wrong views are actually causal factors that determine your rebirth. They, combination of views and actions, will have an effect on what you're going to take in the next as a rebirth after this life is over. So that means a lot, right? If you're interested in setting yourself up for something potentially more beneficial than the life you have now, that would lead toward the grand goals, as I've been calling them, which is awakening and nirvana. And here, the Buddha had this to say: I know of nothing so likely, O monks, when the body breaks up after death, to cause rebirth of beings into a place of suffering, onto a difficult road in destruction or purgatory as wrong view. Wrong view, at the end of the day, if you hold on to wrong views, or if you're keeping wrong views and you're not even aware that you have wrong view, this is going to produce a very unfortunate rebirth for you, the Buddha said. And now I'm just going to wrap up here and give you two long quotes on what he's had to say about wrong view and then right view. In a person of wrong view, wrong aspirations comes into being. In a person of wrong aspiration, wrong speech. In a person of wrong speech, wrong action. In a person of wrong action, wrong livelihood, in a person of wrong livelihood, wrong effort, in a person of wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, in a person of wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration, in a person of wrong concentration, wrong knowledge, in a person of wrong knowledge, wrong release. This is how from wrongness comes failure, not success. And it's important, I think, to note where it all begins, right? It sets up, it's layered in that way in his discourse, I think, intentionally. We need to see it there. Change this to its opposite, and things are likely to be different. So on right view, just as when a sugarcane seed, a rice grain, or a grape seed is placed in moist soil, whatever nourishment it takes from the soil and the water all conduces to its sweetness, tastiness, and pure delectability. Why is that? Because the seed is auspicious. In the same way, when a person has right view, whatever bodily deeds he undertakes in line with that view, whatever mental deeds he undertakes in line with that view, whatever intentions, whatever vows, whatever
determinations,
thank you, whatever fabrications, all lead to what is agreeable, pleasing, charming, profitable, and effortless. Why is that? Because the view is auspicious at the end of the day. And that's where I finish with Gautama's words. And this is the sort of foundation, I think, for setting up practice in a lot of ways in the Pali literature. So, questions or comments? I'm very eager to hear if this resonates. Or
I have one.
Yes.
The period of time that the Buddha lived,
yeah,
was it unusual for princes to be illiterate, or usual for them to be literate? And the reason I ask this is there, if he was literate, why didn't he write anything down?
Well, you know, there are stories of him as a Siddhartha, he who achieves his aims, right? He was very gifted at all of his trainings. The biographies of the Buddhas, when he was growing up in the castle or the palace of his father, the king, Pilavastu, he was gifted at the fine arts, gifted at the martial arts, and he was gifted in philosophy too. Why we don't have texts that he actually wrote, instead we have, in this case, this was remembered by his disciple Ananda, and that's how it gets into the Sutra Pitaka. I don't know how to answer that, other than to say I don't know.
It just seems, not only that question,
but
his was disciples done. Also didn't write things down. The Pali text, the Pali Vis text, they're, what, 4th, 5th century AD? They're not anywhere near the time of the of Buddha. Right?
Well, the first Buddhist council occurs in the year of his death, and this is when the three baskets are, what we say, collected. And they were collected then because people who still spent time with him could gather up all the things that he said in terms of these sorts of quotes, right? And the story is that Ananda remembered every word the Buddha ever said. That's the sort of legend. And another monk named Upali remembered everything the Buddha ever did. And that's how you get the Vinaya, or the basket of the code of conduct. The last basket, the Abhidharma Pitaka, gets developed over time and expands in all sorts of ways depending on the place in which we read it. But it's not put to writing until almost 4 centuries later. It's transmitted orally. And this was very common in that part of the world, though, this oral transmission. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if the idea of writing things down and recording things just hasn't really taken, you know, people had a strange relationship to written language when it first began. You know, I remember reading things about when people first learned to read without actually saying the words out loud. That was deep into the Middle Ages, I think, before people could even do that. You know, it just didn't occur, I don't think, to anybody that you would write this stuff down, because the way you remember things was this oral tradition. Hmm.
And
I wonder if anything else at that time was written down. I think you're in a pre-literate, you know,
well,
society.
You start seeing some of the old Hindu texts coming around, being written before the Pali Canon gets put to writing, which happens in Sri Lanka, far away from where the Buddha lived, up near what's present-day Nepal. But the idea of writing and literacy are not in the same way we often associate them in the South Asian context, right? It's very much an oral tradition, and for these baskets to be transmitted orally over centuries is not uncommon. Prior to this, the texts that we call the Vedas, which are the sort of foundational texts for what becomes Hinduism, they're transmitted orally for almost a millennium. before they're ever even put to writing. And in that case, and the reason is that there was a fear that the content of these texts would get in the wrong hands. And if you transmit it orally, it's easier to determine who's going to have access to it, perhaps, and also to limit it from people from, you know, even hearing it, and there's a bit of control over it. But the nature of the language, in that case Sanskrit, and then Pali, which is very related linguistically speaking, is a very complicated grammar, which allows, if you know it, know how to pronounce it, and you know the grammar, to transmit it orally with very few possibilities for error, which is not something we're used to thinking about. You know, so if we played the telephone game in here and I started something over here, by the time I got to you, chances are good it would not be the same story. That's not really the case. It's actually a lot of errors get introduced in the South Asian literary cultures when they get to writing, because the scribes make mistakes in the things they're writing down.
We're also assuming that people knew how to read.
Well, I mean, that's the assumption a lot, that literacy and reading must be hand in hand. But in the South Asian context, that's not the way it works for a long period of time because of the oral cultures.
Is there any major conflict between the various texts, like, you know, any differences in the fundamental differences in any of the ideas that are, you know, is there any disagreement between them?
Which texts?
I'm thinking, if, you know, if you get something that grew up this way, transmitted, and especially in the Bible, there would be some major changes along the way that maybe were not intended by the Buddha.
Yeah.
And that's what I...
Right. Okay. So the when the Pali Canon gets written down, it's in Sri Lanka. When you pick up the Burmese version of the Pali Canon, you're going to find some stories that are not in the Sri Lankan version that a lot of scholars would say is our oldest available one today. And so you'll get disagreements in that way. Is that there's a saying here that's not apparently in this one over here in this canon. And it becomes a cultural, I think, as it moves. The cultures impact it. And that has, I think, a variety of explanations for that. But a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, as Buddhist practitioners bring their ideas and their texts to new places, there's a process of negotiation with the traditions that are already in place. And this works out in a variety of ways. And in part, you know, you find stories that are filling needs or that are speaking to the various cultural predilections and ideas that are in place to try and make it more intelligible, perhaps, in that way. But some of the basic teachings, like the Four Noble Truths and his discourses on the Four Noble Truths, no self and codependent arising, I would say also the discourses on right view, these are pretty consistent throughout the early literature. When the Mahayana Sutras come into play, everything changes very radically, in a very radical way from what we're reading here.
when you were explicating the basis of wrong view, belief that the self and the world are eternal, that suggested to me an answer to a perennial problem of the environmental movement and those who want to bring change in the world. Why aren't people paying attention to what is manifestly true? There's been a cascade the past week of news about the probable short-lived nature of petrochemical fuels, the short-lived nature of the environment that will support living beings as we're able to be, and other matters, political and economical. And yet, the real news, the meta news, is that very few people are paying attention to those revelations. And I wonder if that isn't because of an underlying view that everything's going to just go right on, that business as usual is the wrong view that operates the world.
I think that's a very interesting application of what was called wrong view in this way. That's an interesting trenchant insight. Yeah.
So on the previous slide, on the wrong views, you had that long chain that ended in wrong release. What? How does that look like? Can you have right nirvana and wrong nirvana?
Well, I
wrong nirvana is really hot.
I think that maybe not non-nirvana would be more appropriate in this case. Yeah, that's good. Thank you. That's a helpful. This is not my translation, by the way. Yeah. But that's
it got me curious.
It is curious. It's very curious. Yeah.
Well, I think there are Zen masters who go against what one would assume is their, you know, kind of true mind or innate nature. I mean, we have these Zen masters in our own sect, you know, that do things that just blatantly go 180 degrees against what we would expect of someone who's reached, you know, that kind of understanding. And I don't know, that sounds like wrong release to me, you know, taking advantage of one's students and justifying it with any kind of, you know, spiritual bullshit. Like, yeah, that's wrong release.
Wrong release, spiritual bullshit. I think I just did it.
Yes. Yeah, the one thing that occurred to me just looking at this whole thing is, you know, when you come to Zen, then all of a sudden there is this awareness of the limitations of language. Mm-hmm. The whole slogan of the initial Zen school is a teaching beyond words and letters, you know, pointing to this reality that can't be encapsulated in this way, which you're not sort of hearing that idea at this point.
No.
And so wrong view becomes any view, and right view becomes no view. You know, basically, to not hold anything in the mind and to see things as they are is not to categorize or to label them.
Yeah. That's nice. That's nice.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
There, you know, and this is, I think, illustrated perhaps, you know, I don't know if. In the Buddhist teachings, insofar as he does a bit, in my mind, it sounds a bit like a broken record. You start hearing the same sorts of answers that he gives to questions that he doesn't find to be useful at all. He'll just redirect them back to where he finds things to be. And so to try and get away from categories, right? The question of nirvana was something we talked about last time I was here. He didn't want to talk about that. This is getting into categorizing a certain state of something, which just gets in the way. Right. And so his is a method, right? We want to have an epistemological structure in place that helps us just to see things as they really are. And in this way, view is a means to an end, right? Rather than simply something that gives us just this right now, and then you're fine. But rather brings us to a place, or brings us to a goal in that way, not a place. Yep.
So in balance, the list here, there's lots and lots of steps. You have the right view, you end up in nirvana. But what you just said to me now sounds like, in looking at the text, that the emphasis is really on that right view. And, you know, the society at the time perhaps had the necessity to incorporate it in the context of nirvana.
Yeah.
But his emphasis was really at the front end, in terms of, because it's a method and a practice. Mm-hmm. And it's not, oh, if we do these things, we're having this goal.
Right.
Like, no. Have I gathered that correctly?
You have. And talking too much about the goals gets in the way, right? It makes you stumble, right, to ever even coming close to the goals, whatever those might be. He of course, was not keen to talk about nirvana, but he had to address it, and his disciples would address it on his behalf when he said, you know, this doesn't help you for me to tell you what this is, even though people ask them all the time. But me telling you how to see things as they really are will help you. Right? And so he's cultivating a kind of, you know, framework of thinking and seeing things as opposed to just holding up a carrot for you. Because, I mean, the method's not easy either, right? You know, it's going to require effort in that way. And these are, of course, just, this is the view here setting up the other parts of the Noble Eightfold Path, which will help you overcome suffering. So there's an incentive there. But I think you're right. Yeah, you know, he's interested in front-ending things so that people can get into the stream, enter the stream of those four categories, the stream enterer and the once returner as well.
I once heard a really neat thing about why it is so difficult to talk about this is because we each have our own experience of it. Like, if I eat a banana and I want to tell you what a banana tastes like, I can say, oh, it's pretty banana-y and squishy and sweet, but until you taste that banana, you have no idea what I'm talking about. And this is what nirvana, this is what all this stuff is, why he can't talk about it, is because it's an experience that we have to experience in order to grasp.
Yeah.
And that's where the words and all the stuff, we try and point to it, but until you actually experience it, that's what really helped me, was that little banana analogy. I always found it like so fast, like, oh yeah, okay, okay.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And
I call those tomatoes.
He mentioned this, you know, if you don't, you need to try these things that I'm telling you, you know, is what he said. You need to experience them for yourself. And if you want to reject what I'm telling you as a right view and call it a wrong view, then so be it. But you need to try it out and experience it. So you're absolutely right. That's critical. That's the idea, part of cultivation. Yeah.
And I think that separates doctrine from dogma.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Where doctrine is set of beliefs that you can start with, experiment for yourself. If they work, keep them. If they don't, discard them. But dogmas, as my understanding of the word, this is the beliefs. If you don't believe them, you don't belong to our whatever faith. And if you do, then you belong to our faith.
Yeah,
well, that's orthodoxy.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's a nice distinction.
That was a conversation.
Exclamation point.
I was really hoping to circle this back to meditation, but I can't compete with what John said.
Well, that's what Roshi says. Roshi says, you know, ultimately, practice isn't like reading about it. It's, you know, you don't have to remember all this eightfold path. It comes down to being fully present. Just practicing the meditation of being fully present, all this comes alive. So that's the Zen.
There's something.
I wanted to jump on what he was saying. Do you know if the texts themselves might have been a seed to certain practices, like, you know, they were memorizing them. Were they memorizing them just so that they can keep track of them, or was that viewed also as a form of practice? And the study of the text, was that viewed as just, you know, you do it so that you can keep it, or was that seen as being transformative in some fashion?
The text themselves.
The text, the study of them, and even the memorization of them.
Yeah,
the
studying. The studying, absolutely. Yes, and meditation's a component in this way too, but not in the way that Zen becomes a practice. It's a very different sort of way, but the study of the text, and this is where you find the label given to Theravada and the other 18 early Buddhist schools of small vehicle, right? Because it's only for a few people who can actually get on board with that, right? It's transformative in and of itself, the teachings and the studying of the teachings and the teaching of the teachings. Yeah.
I was struck by your introduction when you mentioned that Buddhist scholarship became focused in the Western world in the late 18th century.
Yeah.
And in the late 20th century, we started wondering, is this a practice? It's almost like having a future civilization looking at car and driver for 200 years before saying, you mean you actually make cars?
Yeah.
And drive them?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, this is, I think, a problem, right? And this is why it was deemed a problem, right? Around the mid 20th century, is that we need to stop just pretending that this is a textual tradition that has existed in this part of, you know, the world for so long, and start realizing that it's an actual embodied tradition, and people are practicing in these texts, as ideal as they may be, actually are generative in society. They're meant to produce something, produce people, certain sorts of people in the way that they see and view the world and so on. It is, and this is why people, thankfully, the scholarship has changed. That's primarily just in Europe and in North America. Scholarship in, you know, of course, Asia on these things is a different bag of material. But that's the sort of, you know, I'm speaking in a broad brushstroke too. This is the sort of generalization of the scholarship. There are always exceptions to those rules.
I've been wondering about this difference or this comparison of oral and written tradition.
Yeah.
And, for the first several generations of Buddhism, these doctrines were transmitted orally,
right?
And using this, it appears in this facility for a critical memory that we don't encounter very much in our modern society.
That's true.
And I wonder then if the comparative value of writing could be understood in how we apply writing in our zendo. We chant sutras, and this is how I think for us, the first way that we encounter them directly, through our chants, and we offer the chant books for people who haven't memorized them, mm-hmm. haven't put them to memory already, you know. So I think whereas if you're a teacher who has already, you know, is engaged in teaching somebody day after week, it's practical just, you know, to put things to memory and recite these doctrines using, you know, your head. You don't have to need to keep a book around.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering where this goes. I'm sorry, it's just more of an observation than perhaps than a question.
Well, it's not unusual in the history of South Asian literary cultures for this practice, memorization of Sanskrit, Pali texts, other languages, other vernacular languages too, where there's a large body of work. And you see children from a very young age being trained in the recitation of texts, and they're often different stages of this memorization, where it goes from simply just reciting an entire text, however long that text might be, and learning how to say it. You don't have any clue as to what's even being said often for some of these small children. And then you go back to the beginning of the text and you start to learn what the words are that you've been saying and you've been learning to memorize for however many years. And that is the process of actually understanding the nature of the text, if it's a philosophical text or practical text. I work with people who memorize texts for medical purposes. They, you know, trained in this really old-fashioned way, 2,000-year-old method. And then there's a third level after you learn what you've just been saying. You now know what you've been saying or reciting. Is incorporated into a network of teachings that plays with other texts, and so it requires extensive years and years of study and a master who's gone through that kind of training with him or herself as well. And it's not uncommon in the history of South Asian literary cultures, but it's increasingly uncommon to find today, even in India or in South Asia. There's a crisis in the classics in that way, I think, in India, which is not my phrase, the crisis in the classics, but there is a crisis in the classics in terms of people's engagement with their classical literature in the way that I've just described to you, whether it be in a Buddhist context or a Hindu context or non-religious context, but in the study of medicine or in the study of philosophy or something like we used to see. But there are no physical texts in that learning. The text exists between you, the teacher, and me, the student. and it only comes out in the discourse that we have, or you correcting me because I'm not pronouncing it correctly, or something like that. That's the text in that way. So the text becomes a kind of field. I think really an interesting part of that part of the world.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. So what is this, Buddhist, among Buddhist scholars, what is the view of when was this first written down? We know that how old the Pali text was, but when was the first text?
Yeah, so the idea is that it goes down to orally transmitted to Sri Lanka around the first century before the Common Era, and this is when we start to see it. But it's not the version we have available today. It's, you know, produced. I'm hard pressed to tell you what date that would be, but I would say it would be centuries later. You know, the ones that we can read today.
And there were schools of scribes that were copyists, like in other traditions.
Yeah, exactly. Within the Sangha, people who specialized in that. And then, just like in any sort of society where people belong to a kind of ruling class, they also will. It was a very special thing, a sign of authority, to be able to have certain sacred texts within one's possession. So you would commission somebody to make these texts for you, and then you would keep them in your own private library and maybe read them, maybe not. This happens with the Buddhist texts, depending on the various political powers or regimes that are, you know, coming and going throughout this part of the world. Not in Sri Lanka, but that one's pretty consistent for quite a long time with a few small incursions. But in India, it comes and goes, and then ultimately just goes. Once the Muslims arrived.
Prior to paper, they would have been written on palm fronds?
Yeah, palm leaves. I brought an old palm leaf manuscript to the last talk. I can bring it next time if I think. It's about 100 years old, nowhere near what we're talking about here. But it's on dry palm leaves, and then it's etched with a stylus into the palm leaf, these really thin, dried out palm leaves, and then a kind of black graphite substance is smeared across the top so that it sinks in, but no ink is put on them, which would deteriorate the palms a little bit more quickly. And then they're usually capped between two solid pieces of wood, maybe decorated. The one I have is decorated on top. It's quite nice. It's actually written in Sinhalese script.
I think we're about at time.
Okay. Thanks for all these great comments.